Hi, I'm Deb.
This is Frankie V.
I'm Grant.
Hi, this is Phil.
I'm Aaron.
I'm Steven.
Hi, I'm Jim.
Hi, I'm Matt.
We're Tim and Terry.
I'm Susan.
Hi, this is Phil.
Seminary Dropout is supported by listeners like you and me.
Seminary Dropout is supported by listeners like you and me.
You should support the show like I did.
It's easy.
It's easy.
Just visit supportseminarydropout.com.
Just go to supportseminarydropout.com.
And I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. Interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers. Let's go.
My guest, A.J. Swoboda, is Assistant Professor of Bible, Theology, and World Christianity at Bushnell University. He also leads a Doctor of Ministry program around the Holy Spirit and leadership at Fuller Theological Seminary. He's the author of a number of books, including the award-winning Subversive Sabbath. He's married to Quinn and is a proud father of Elliot. They live and work in Eugene, Oregon, and his latest book is called After Doubt, How to Question Your Faith Without Losing It. And he has also got a new podcast that he's co-hosting with Nijay Gupta called In Faith and Doubt, which is kind of an extension of the book. AJ, welcome back to Seminary Dropout. That's super cool about the podcast. Tell me about that real quick.
Well, first of all, Shane, and I fear that people can't see you. Your beard is looking epic. I've already expressed that in the clearest of terms. You look good. It's great to be with you once again. Yeah. So the podcast In Faith and Doubt really is kind of two things. It's kind of an extension of this book because the book can't cover the whole conversation around doubt and deconstruction. But more importantly, I think secondly is we both have just come across so many people who are trying to follow Jesus in these ridiculously complex moments in time. And what we're trying to do is give a sense of clarity in the midst of the fires that surround us. How do we follow Jesus in these very odd moments where it is a very funky time to be a Christian?
I think I want to, for purposes of our conversation, I think it's really important that we kind of just define the term specifically deconstruction, because I feel like that means 1,000 different things to 1,000 different people. And so, what do you mean when you say deconstruction and when you write about it in this book?
Yep. Well, the book actually came out, After Doubt came out only 3 weeks ago. It's actually just been out for a few weeks now. And any author, you know, any author worth their salt almost immediately starts having regrets about things that they've written. And one thing I wish I would have been more given more forethought to in the book was actually giving definitions to the difference between doubt and deconstruction, because these terms are I think they're adjacent, but they're not the same thing. I would define doubt as, and I borrow this from John 20, when this disciple named Thomas, who's doubting the resurrection of Jesus. Doubt is an experience that we walk through when we are having a hard time believing something that we already embrace. So doubt is a sort of epistemic internal struggle to receive something that is already ours, right? So we don't doubt things that we've never embraced. We reject those things. Deconstruction, so doubt happens to us. Deconstruction is a little bit different in that it is a bit more proactive, and it entails the intentional dismantling of certain things that we do believe. Deconstruction is obviously something that could be found in just about any dimension and domain of human life, architecture, making a pie. You know, you deconstruct cookies to make a crust. My son deconstructs his Lego sets all the time to rebuild something new. Deconstruction is something that happens all over the place. But when it deals with theology and spiritual formation, what we're really talking about here is we're talking about moments in our journey with God where we intentionally dismantle things that we previously held on to.
Yeah.
So in a way, doubt happens to us. Deconstruction tends to be we do deconstruction. So it's a bit, I think it's one is more active and one is more passive. And I ultimately would argue actually that deconstruction is often the result
of not appropriately dealing with our doubts. So when we don't deal with our doubts, it eventually leads to deconstruction.
Oh, that's really helpful. That's so good. I think a lot of times when I out in the wild, whether it's like social media or whatever, when I hear people say they've deconstructed something or claim they've deconstructed something, it seems like they almost always mean that they've abandoned the belief in that, which like there's almost the kind of idea that if you've deconstructed, you can't then go back and affirm the belief that you deconstructed. Does that make sense? Which I think sounds like a fallacy. It should like that it shouldn't be that way, that you can't, if I believe something, you can't assume that I've never deconstructed it.
Yeah, actually, oftentimes the beliefs that we hold strongest are beliefs that at one point we did deconstruct. And because, you know, when you go through the deconstruction process regarding whatever it may be, you get down to the floorboard of what you think. There's a philosopher years ago, this kind of well-known philosopher talked about, her name was Mary Cullen. She talked about this idea of our belief structure as the pipes in our house. And she says, nobody sits around and just thinks about their pipes. You only think about the pipes when the pipes stop working and your kitchen is flooded. And all of a sudden you're like, oh my gosh, I got to start thinking about pipes. And she says, often don't think about our beliefs in such a way that we only think about them when they stop working for us. And so I think actually the book invites us to think about what we believe before our house floods, because beliefs and theology really do matter. And you and I both know this, Shane. When a young person is handed an idea about Jesus that is not true and does not reflect the historic Jesus that Scripture speaks of, we set that person up down the road to have to undo that belief. And ultimately, can lead to resentment and rejection of the entire Christian narrative. You know, in the Old Testament, Book of Exodus tells us to not misuse God's name. And I think that entails not passing along false ideas of God, because ultimately when you pass along false ideas of God, you are creating the need for deconstruction.
Yeah, that's so good. That's so good and helpful. And so I was thinking about like kind of my own deconstruction journey as I was reading the book, and you spend a considerable amount of time praising deconstruction and the deconstruction that is good for us and healthy. And for myself, I, for instance, you know, growing up in a pretty conservative environment, since then, I've deconstructed a number of things. I've deconstructed what I was taught and used to believe about women in ministry. I kind of used to have this, at least functionally, have this belief that the Bible just kind of fell from the sky as it was. And so I kind of deconstructed that. You know, some of my beliefs about hell being kind of eternal conscious torment, all of these things that I feel have in the end given me a greater love for God and the biblical narrative and Jesus. And so I wonder if you could just speak to that, just the necessity of deconstruction and the role that it can play in a healthy Christian life.
Yeah, you know, there's this sort of false, this false binary of extremities in the Christian church right now, where you have essentially on one hand representative of sort of right, far right Christianity that would say deconstruction is always bad, it's demonic, run away from it. And then this other side, represented by progressive Christianity, that almost demands deconstruction in order to be a Christian. Jesus isn't the only way to God, but your deconstruction process is your only way to God. And in a way, you have these two false binaries. One demonizes deconstruction and one valorizes and requires it. Yeah. And I'm just highly convinced, Shane, that there is a third way that is the way of Jesus. And it doesn't demonize and it doesn't valorize. It walks in a different way. Because, for example, there is good deconstruction. For example, Jesus deconstructed. When you look at Matthew 5-7, when Jesus is the Sermon on the Mount, giving his greatest ethical teachings on what it looks like to follow the way of Jesus, he says, you have heard it said. He's, of course, speaking of the Pharisees and Sadducees. You've heard it said, what they've said to you.
But I say to you, and then he lays out an entirely different way of seeing the Old Testament. That is you and I, that is deconstruction. He is deconstructing wrong ways of imagining the Bible. Now, here's what's interesting. Jesus deconstructed false interpretations of the Bible, but Jesus never deconstructed the Bible. The Bible for him was his life source. I mean, he was highly committed to the first 37 books of the Bible. 39 books of the Bible, the Old Testament. Jesus defended it. He gave his life to this book, but he didn't deconstruct it. He deconstructed false ways of understanding it. Mm-hmm. And that's the difference between, I think, healthy deconstruction and unhealthy deconstruction. There is a difference between deconstructing false understandings about the Bible and God and on the other hand, deconstructing the faith and saying Jesus is not the Son of God. So we have to be cautious because not all deconstruction is the destruction of belief of the faith.
Yes.
But sometimes deconstruction can lead to the deconstruction can lead to the destruction of the living faith that we are called to have.
Okay. I'm so glad you said that because I have here highlighted in your book something that I wanted to read, just a couple of sentences that I wanted to ask you something about. So this is towards the beginning. This is on page 26. And you say, deconstruction is a double-edged sword. It can edify our faith by helping us critically rethink wrong beliefs, but it can also go too far and bring our faith to nothing. Any belief we uncritically receive at some point that remains hostile or opposed to the biblical message of Jesus Christ needs to be deconstructed. But the minute deconstruction undermines the gospel, our faith, or the Bible, we've deconstructed too much. So, AJ, because I know you and I've read your books, I think I know what you mean by that. But I'm afraid that when people read that, they're going to hear, don't ask too many questions. Like ask questions about the peripheral stuff, but don't ask too many questions about the Bible and Jesus himself and the core of Christianity. Like don't look too hard into that and don't question too much about that.
Yeah. Shane, you're a stud and your beard is a stud. Thank you for such a good question. So let me make this very practical for you in terms of a real kind of situation that I found myself in. I'm sitting in my office here. My office hours are often full with students who come in with good Bible and theology questions. And when I sit with a student in my office who's struggling with doubt or they're beginning to undo some beliefs that they were given at some point in their life, they will often ask me, is doubt or deconstruction, is it bad? And the most important question that I can get to is not to give them an immediate answer. It's actually to ask a question back in a classic Jesus move. And my question is why are you doing it? What is the reason you're doing it? If a student sits in my office and says, well, the truth is, I was handed a theology that said that women are footnotes in the kingdom. We're nobody. We're horrible. We're not important. And it's causing me to not love Jesus anymore. And the student says, I love God with all my heart and I want to follow Jesus with all my heart. If somebody's desire is to truly follow the King of the universe, the Son of God, the Son of David, the one who bears a kingdom, and your desire is to love God, whatever it takes, I would say deconstruct whatever in the world is getting in the way of pursuing the historic Jesus. Get it? Mm-hmm. I don't want to follow ideas. I want to follow Jesus. If your hunger and desire is Jesus at all costs, amen. But you and I both know, Shane, that from time to time, we encounter people who are going through deconstruction. And when we ask why, really what's going on is not that they want to follow Jesus. Really what's going on is at the end of the day, they actually really just want to sleep with who they want to sleep with.
Yeah.
And actually at the end of the day are really tired of having a God that gives them a way of life and is really tired of having a book that has things to say that they don't want to hear. And if that is the reason we are deconstructing, because honestly, we just want to do what we want to do, that is a very dark road that will not end in good spaces. At the end of the day, Shane, all of our heroes in the faith who have had the greatest impact on this world are people who asked really hard questions and lost sleep over those questions. But when we ask those questions, we need to do it with the desire to actually follow Jesus, not with the desire to do away with him. So I would say, Shane, ask all the questions as long as you are asking because you really want to love God.
Yeah. So that was really helpful because what I'm hearing you say is there are no problems with honest searches.
My gosh, read the Psalms. I mean, you can't tell me by reading the Psalms that we are invited to not ask questions. Ellen Davis at Duke University says the Psalms are the First Amendment of the Bible. They are our free speech before the living God. If the Psalms are actually biblical, then we are not only invited to ask God our real questions, I would say we're required to.
Yeah. And so oftentimes those who are trying to deconstruct, the problem is not that they're asking the questions, but that it's not an honest search. It's, I want to get to this point over here, which is me doing what I want to do or not believing things that are really inconvenient for me or are really problematic in my culture today.
That is, Shane, I mean, we are ripping off your, this is a classic Jesus move. When you read the Gospels, there's a whole book by Konrad Gempf, who's a German scholar, called Jesus Asked. He wrote a whole book on all the questions that Jesus asked or was asked. And he points out that every time that somebody asks a question of Jesus with the intent to trap him, he never answers the question. He either is silent or he puts the question back on the questioner. But when a person comes to Jesus with an honest to goodness, true faith question, he always responds in a way that gives insight, life, and direction. I don't know if our questions are honest. Sometimes we come to Jesus with questions to trap him. When we come to the Bible to trap the Bible, that's a dishonest question. That is not an honest set of questions that is birthed out of faith. That is our desire to follow the voice of the serpent who said, did God really say da, 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 da?
One of the things that you talk about in the book is just our problem with the idea, and I don't think you put it in this term, but I put it in the terms of lordship, like that we are answerable to someone. You use this word sovereign. You tell this great story. I don't know if you want to tell it about the evangelist from it was England who came over to the U.S. in the mid 1900s.
Yeah, I tell the story in the book about this very well known evangelist from Britain who came to the United States to do a series of evangelistic talks. And he walks into this old sort of colonial gift shop. I believe it's in Philadelphia when the story is told. And he walks in and he sees all these sort of pictures and paraphernalia and imagery from the earliest sort of colonial era. And, you know, he sees things like don't tread on me and, you know, taxation without representation. And one of them in particular kind of stops him in his tracks, which is about the rejection of the sovereign king. And of course, when you look at American history, when you look at the history of Europeans who came to the Americas, the Europeans who came here, who eventually established the nation of the United States of America, the reason they came was in some sense a rejection of sovereign king, taxation without representation, the distant king who tells us stuff but who we don't get to speak back to. And so the American psyche is a rejection of the sovereign. And this particular evangelist just sort of made a comment. He said it's really hard to preach God to people who reject the idea of the sovereign. There's an idea. Walter Hooper was a friend of C.S. Lewis who made a similar comment in one of his introductions to Lewis's books, which I believe was Christian Reflections. And in the foreword, he says, you know, people who believe in freedom, their greatest temptation is that they start believing that they get to freely choose who God is.
And I think what's taking place right now is I think we are so obsessed with our own individualistic expression, our own expressive individualistic tendencies, that we get to sort of curate our own life and become our own identities and shape who we are. It has now gotten to the point where I suspect we think we can sort of make God into who we want God to be. You know, the old Reinhold Niebuhr quote, God made us in his image, but we've been really good at returning the favor. Mm-hmm. So in a lot of ways, I think there is something in the American Western psyche that really does think we'll worship God as long as God is who we want him to be. And I hear it my students all the time. A student, when I did a whole class on hell last semester, and when a student says, I could only believe in a God who dot, 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 dot. I could only believe in a God who, you know, thinks about hell the way I do, or thinks about sexuality the way I do. I could only believe in a God who, what we're really saying there is we're saying, I'll love God as long as God is who I want him to be. And that's, we have a word for that. That's called idolatry.
What you're saying, what I know you're saying when you say that, I agree with. I think there is a, and like push back, please, but I think there's a ditch. I think there's a ditch on the other side, because I have people that I love very much, my good Reformed friends, who will tell me God preordains murder and genocide and rape for his glory. And the reason I don't, the reason I have a problem with that is because his ways are so above my ways and so different than my ways. So my issue with that is, it's, if that is true, not just that God's, it's not just that God's ways are above my ways, it's that they are like actually backwards than my ways. And if that's true, that I am, that the mechanism inside of me is so off, the judgment mechanism is so off, then how can I even judge that God is good and loving and that I should try to want to follow him in the first place? If whatever that is, the mechanism, the judger inside of me is so backwards, then how do I even know that God is good? And so there has to be some kind of connection to, God's goodness and my understanding of that. Does that make sense?
100%.
Is that fair?
Well, yeah. And I don't want to take our space to caricature, anybody's, you know, I don't want to caricature the Reformed tribe. I don't want to caricature the Arminian tribe. I don't want to caricature anybody right here. I think here's what I think. I think God is true and every man is a liar. And that's Paul's language. In Romans, he says, God, let God be true and every man a liar. And what that means is this. There are elements in Calvinist Reformed theology that just do not reflect who Jesus is. But Shane, you and I both know in our tribes, and I'm more on the Arminian camp, there is plenty on the Arminian side that does not reflect who Jesus is.
Sure.
As much as on the Calvinist side. And at the end of the day, I think all of our theologies have elements that reflect who Jesus is, and all of them don't. And that we all have the responsibility to constantly be open to once again being corrected by what God has said in his greatest book. That in the end of the day, right, at the end of the day, the Bible is inspired. Our interpretations are not. And all of our interpretations often need to get reshaped and remade by what God has spoken about himself. So this is not, and I should say this too, Shane, this is not about getting progressives to become conservatives. This is not about getting conservatives to become progressives. This is not about getting Calvinists to become Arminians or Arminians Calvinists. This is that we are all liars. And Jesus is the center. And all of us have the responsibility to be open to the God who from time to time shatters our theology. That's, by the way, yes. C.S. Lewis's entire point in a major section of A Grief Observed is that often we worship our theology more than we worship Jesus. And when you actually worship Jesus, from time to time, he shatters our theology. Lewis calls Jesus the great iconoclast, who from time to time comes and shatters our theology, and actually says that is the sign that you worship him.
the sign that you worship Jesus is that you're open to being corrected by him, right? So
yeah.
This is my way of saying, Shane, we have to look at all of our theology through the lens of Jesus. And if something that we believe about God is not reflected by the person of Jesus, who was incarnate Son of God, who died on the cross for human beings across time and space, served lepers, washed feet, cared for the disenfranchised, made women a central part of his mission. If what we believe does not reflect who Jesus is, then it is not Jesus. And it needs to be corrected in light of who Jesus is. And I have a very difficult time imagining any God. Yes, in scripture, we have moments where God invites Israel to do extremely horrific things. And as a dad, if my son had cancer, I would be put into a position of having to fill his body with a poison to save his life. Sometimes you do absolutely horrible things in the name of love that you never would ever want to do in the normal world. But to say that God desires genocide as a way to show his glory to the world is like saying we love pumping children with poison as a way of showing them that we love them. We don't do it because we want to do it. We do it because it's our last option.
And I think also the other side of that ditch, which is what you've been talking about, is that we can often, when I hear people talk about, you know, seeing their theology or reading the Bible through the lens of Jesus, which I absolutely affirm, but I think that often we then make Jesus whoever we want him to be. Like, you know, we filter Jesus through my lens of being, you know, whatever, white neoliberal, and what I think is nice, then Jesus must have also thought is nice. And so it's my trump yeah. card to read the Bible and theology however I want to.
That's exactly right. And that, Shane, is not something that is in any way, shape, or form isolated to one side of the ideological spectrum. I mean, on one hand, you have sort of this alt-right Christianity that really does identify America as sort of God's only mouthpiece on this planet. And we are essentially the new Israel, wedding together nationalism and God's salvation plan. That is a form of creating God in our own image, just as taking the parts of the Bible that we like and then chucking everything that it says about sexuality out because we don't like it. That is doing the same exact thing. It is, it is in essence, creating God in our image. And now I think that's a dangerous place to be, essentially, when we come to the point where we think Jesus is following us. That's a dangerous place to be.
So one of the things I see out there from certain Christians is that when they encounter people who are deconstructing or deconstructed on the other side of it and maybe came out on places that we don't like, they see those people as an enemy to be conquered. And it's one thing I like about the book is that is not your tone. That's not who you are. So it wouldn't be. And it also makes it sometimes challenging to even engage because sometimes people have their feelings are just so raw when they've gone through deconstruction. Yeah. And they have often legitimate wounds and hurts from the church. I have noticed that people, when I hear the stories of people who have gone through deconstruction and decided that Christianity and the church is not for me. I don't know if you've noticed this, but I've noticed a pattern where they are often coming from a mega church experience where the church was treated like a business and kind of run like a business, or the opposite, where maybe it was smaller, but it was more really fundamentalist in nature. And when I hear those stories, I think, that's the thing you went through is awful. That's terrible. I know that those churches are out there because I see them like online and in the media. But like, I don't know if you've had this feeling, but the pastors, the women and men who are pastors and church leaders that I consider friends of mine, that I spend time with, that I read, that I talk to, they are nothing like either one of those. Like, they are worlds apart from those experiences, churches that I'm acquainted with. Now, they're certainly imperfect. And if you spend enough time with anybody, you'll be wounded at some point. But it's just so different. And I just mourn. It's heartbreaking when people are leaving the church because that is the only expression of Christianity that they've experienced.
Wow, Shane, you hit on a lot of things there. I mean, my initial gut reaction is the majority of people who I know or am walking with or have walked with who have gone through the deconstruction journey, more often than not, they did so not because they had some liberal professor that undid their faith. More often than not, it was that they saw behind the curtain of the church and they saw stuff that was wrong. And that, you and I would both agree, is not a size issue. Big or small can be as equally damaging and traumatic for anybody. But when you observe, again, I have very few friends who like picked up a Frederick Schleiermacher book and I'm like, I don't believe in the Bible anymore. More often than not, there are deep wounds towards the church that have caused us to run away. And actually, I guess in a way that's really helped me understand the parable of the prodigal sons. You have these two sons, an older son who stays at home, a younger son who runs away. He takes the inheritance. He goes off to the city and parties, wakes up, sort of realizes what's going on, wants to go back to the father. When you read that story, it's not even addressed, but I think it's a legitimate question. Why did the young son run away? And the text doesn't suggest really what happened. I have my theory. I think that the younger son ran away because he was really hurt by the older brother. And he eventually ran away because he just couldn't handle the rigidity. And he saw what was wrong with the older brother. He's like, I'm done. And sadly, you and I see so many people walking away from Jesus, not because Jesus did something, but because the older brother was a jerk.
Yeah.
And the older brother didn't care. And the older brother didn't exemplify the father's household code. And so we eventually end up running away from the father because of the older son. But I got to say, we need the younger sons to come back, because don't let the older sons win the household.
Yeah.
Come back, return, because Jesus is too good to run away because you got hurt by a bad Christian. Like, oh my goodness gracious. Christians are broken, fundamentally broken individuals. But they are not an argument for God's non-existence. I've from time to time been a really bad son. That does not mean my parents don't exist. And just because Jesus has some really bad followers doesn't mean he's not real.
You know, AJ, if you've spent enough time in the church, you've been hurt by the church. Like, maybe it's a small way. I don't know about you, but I take comfort in a few things. One, when I'm having doubts, I take comfort in knowing that I have no question, and I could never have a question that no one has asked before me and come out with faith on the other side. Like there's nothing in my faith that I could ask that no one before me has never asked. And
that's exactly.
And come out the other side. The other is, so many times when people say, and this is our context, so, you know, United States, when people say the church and Christians, they mean the white church in the United States of America. And the white church in the United States of America, it is part of the church, has had a lot of problems, still has them, is not the majority of the church, even talking about people living now, but especially when we talk about history, we talk about the saints that went before us. You know, white people, we're the minority in Christianity, both historically and now living. The church is thriving and looks vastly different in different parts of the world. And
absolutely,
to me, it seems as though we are being shaped by culture, and it is causing us to deconstruct in ways that the church in China, the church in Africa, like, they're not deconstructing in that way. And for us to say that our way is better and superior, I just feel as though boy, it's just time for us to just kind of sit at the feet of the people who are experiencing Christianity in different contexts.
100%. The very fact of the matter is that there is no question anybody has asked in our moment in history that is anything new. We have 2,000 years of not only in church history, we have 4,000 years of ancient Jewish history of people who have been asking these questions for a long time. And the, you know, C.S. Lewis's idea of chronological snobbery, we really do think that we've arrived and we're a different kind of unique group of people. We're not. We're the same old broken people that every person who's ever tried to follow Jesus has ever been. And to say nothing of the fact, to your point, in the global Christian community, the white church is a part of the church, and it is not to be shamed for being a part of the church. It is a beautiful part of the church, and it is a broken part of the church that desperately right now needs to learn to listen to, honestly, we need to listen to poor and more. We need to listen to the poor. I mean, when you go to any environment, places like Africa, where you've got Christians in poverty following Jesus, they are going to help us see straight. And we need to go to non-white environments to hear what Christians in China and in Korea and in the Philippines and are hearing from the Spirit of Jesus, because there's a reason we have four Gospels. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the early church refused to have one voice to tell the story of Jesus. And you need all four. And it, to say that we have got it is like saying Matthew works, but Mark, Luke, and John should sort of not be listened to. No, we need all four. We need to listen to the other three.
Before we go, I just want to give a nod to this book is in two parts. And the second part is about practices. And I think I love that, because we are not, it would be so Western to say we're going to think ourselves out of this, but it is actually something that we practice, and we're being formed in so many ways. We so often practice our way into new ways of thinking instead of the other way around.
Yeah, no, just, I mean, there are a lot of books on doubt, but I had yet to find one that really outlines spiritual disciplines, ancient practices, for how to walk through it. And I think that was why I highlight these practices. And I think there's eight of them in the book as legitimate steps that we can take to walk through these doubt experiences and these deconstruction experiences. So the hope would be, you're exactly right, that we would be able to actually follow Jesus through doubt and deconstruction.
AJ, thank you so much. Anybody who wants links to, you've got a website, right?
AJ Swoboda Writes, WRITES.
Okay. Cool. I'll put a link to it on the show notes. Are you on Twitter? I couldn't find you. Are you done with Twitter? Yep. You are? Okay.
No, MR AJ Swoboda.
Okay.
MR AJ Swoboda, Mr. AJ Swoboda.
Okay, cool. I'll link to that too. The book is called After Doubt, How to Question Your Faith Without Losing It. AJ, and I love you, my friend.
Thank you
so much for talking with me.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code SeminaryDropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported.
You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah, that's my best.